Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past 2021. The Historical Novel Society Australasia acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live. We pay respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. In this season of Imagining the Past, we'll take a sneak peek at writers and issues showcased at this year's Historical Novel Society Australasia's virtual conference, which will be held over two successive weekends on the 16th and 17th of October and the 22nd to 24th of October 2021. The online conference offers boot camps and craft workshops, with the main conference program featuring 2 days of interviews, panels and chat salons for both writers and readers of historical fiction. For more information, please visit hnsa.org.au. In our upcoming podcast, I'll be chatting with some of the conference guests about their work and their inspirations. So pop on the kettle, pop on your headphones, and let's start imagining the past. Stephen Conte is the author of two historical novels, The Zookeeper's War, 2007, and The Tolstoy Estate, 2020. In 2008, The Zookeeper's War won the inaugural Prime Minister's Award for Fiction and went on to be published in the UK, Ireland, and Spain. In 2021, The Tolstoy Estate was shortlisted for the Walter Scott Prize for Historical Fiction and will soon be released in the Netherlands, Italy, and Germany. I started by welcoming Stephen to Imagining the Past.
Thanks so much, Greg, for having me. I appreciate your interest.
To start, I'd just like to cast back to a young Stephen Conte in Gyra in New South Wales, which is an era with a rich history of storytelling, from the little boy lost to the Gyra ghost, and imaginative place names like Mother of Ducks Lagoon and Thunderbolt's Cave. And my favourite was the vegan-friendly Lamb and Potato Festival. I'm just wondering what your first inkling was to become a writer.
Well, those are a bunch of terrific local references there, Greg. I must have realised in kindergarten at the Gyra Central School, because that was when I first published a story in the school magazine about the Titanic, which opened with the immortal sentence, clang, clang, clang went the ship's bell. So I was immediately high on the attention it generated. So at that early stage, it was an interest, which of course flowed, like many writers when you investigate, flowed from having been read to as a child. And I think that warm connection that I had in my case with my mother was setting me up for a lifetime of enjoying reading and writing and stories.
So how did those desires and those thoughts coalesce into 20th century European history?
Well, I think I, once again, in my reading as it developed, it became quite Eurocentric in a way. And I trace that really to the odd formative experience of growing up in a boys' boarding school. So that was a fairly brutal, a fairly tough environment. And so for me, reading became a kind of sanctuary and a place of a safe place for me. And I had been reading long books, you know, partly to be absorbed. And from Lord of the Rings, I went, for example, by far the most precocious early reading was at the age of 14, picking up War and Peace. But, before elaborating on those European-flavoured stories that I came to enjoy, I think the way that I've analysed it since is that my experience of being confined in that institution was, in a sense, a type of archetypal European experience. If you think of the opposite, the archetypal American or Australian experience and literary experience, it's an encounter with the great expanses. So at the end of Huckleberry Finn, for example, Huck strikes out for the territories. There's always a new place to go, or famously in Australian literature, Voss, you know, it's this encounter with the desert. But growing up, I was in this strange European-like institution, well, it was a great British public school was what it was modelled on. And so there was a sense of confinement, entrapment. And I think that is reflected in European literature, which spoke to me that you're confined by class, by geography, by topography, you're hemmed in tenements or strict social caste. And so it just, as I grew and grew up and my reading developed, it was European writers who were primarily appealing to me.
And what was the first kind of inspiration you had for the Tolstoy estate? How did that first come to be?
So often I've noticed now there's a pattern with me that it is a setting that is actually the initial inspiration for my works. And in this case, I came across an extraordinary book which provided the stimulus for it. And that is Journey Among Warriors by Eva Curie. Now, Eva was the writer daughter of Marie Curie, who was also her mother's biographer and had made a name of her for herself as her mother's biographer. Well, when the war broke out, she was based in Paris and did a series of escapes from the Nazis and ended up in New York. And in New York, being a speaker of multiple languages, she was given a job by Time magazine to take a tour of the war. And it was, you know, an extraordinary adventure that she was then on. It has a real Casablanca vibe to it, you know, flying boat to the Bahamas, across the Atlantic, dot, 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 across to Cairo and the North African campaign, where she was met, amongst others, Randolph Churchill, Churchill's son. She had a whole variety of celebrities that she met along the way, including Gandhi. But the part of her book that gave me the inspiration was when she visited very early in 1942 the recently liberated Tolstoy estate to the southwest of Moscow. And it was there that she spoke to the local custodians who had been defending the house and Tolstoy's memory against this brief German occupation, this 6 weeks late in 1941, when the Germans set up a field hospital at the former Tolstoy estate. And what she noted and was struck by, and what in turn I was struck by, was the way in which the Russians and the Germans alike were ultra conscious of Tolstoy's presence lingering over the estate, because it was already a national shrine. And for Tolstoy, being the national, in a way, this national figure describing the Russian defense against a foreign invader, it gave, in this case, Napoleon in War and Peace, everyone there had this sense of the ideological significance of the place, and even the metaphysical significance of the place, that if they could prevail here, the Germans could prevail on the whole Russian nation, the Soviet nation as it was then. So I just thought that was a terrific setting. It had that unity of place and of time, and it gave me a starting place to imagine the characters.
So when you read this book of Curie's, were you hit by a lightning bolt, or was this something that you kind of had to macerate for quite a while to bring to a novel?
I think it was more that like a lightning bolt. I have half an eye out. It wasn't a completely conscious process, but I suppose in my first published novel, I had the Berlin Zoo. And so in a sense, I'm developing what is unintentionally a type of genre, but obviously it speaks to me as a way of proceeding, a confined setting that allows, you know, if you like, a little bit like a boys' boarding school where the characters are thrust together. And yeah, I had immediate awareness that this was such a place. I mean, from a technical perspective, when you write a novel, people who have paid any attention to it know that, okay, there needs to be conflict. But one of the questions is, in real life, people typically walk away from conflict. And so you need a device that holds people together and prevents them from just walking away. And, you know, a classic device or situation would be a marriage or a family. And if you're not writing about marriage and family, you need another reason for the characters to be stuck in the middle with you, if you like.
In the cauldron, really. I just wonder how your research proceeded, and if you speak Russian and German, or if you ran into problems by not speaking them.
Yeah, so it's one of the things that is embarrassing to admit is that although I'm a speaker of Italian to a moderate level, I've never learned Russian or German. So to that extent, it is a type of smoke and mirrors, which a lot of readers are a little bit disappointed to hear. You know, there's a yearning for deep authenticity. But in reading translations of memoirs by Germans and Russian people, there is, especially if they're literary types, there is an engagement with their own language, a sort of a self-reflexiveness. And so you certainly get the vibe of a language from reading it in translation. You know, to read Arabic speakers, for example, in translation is quite different from hearing Chinese people speaking in translation. You get, I would contend that you get a feel for what it is like to communicate in that language. So that obviously presents difficulties. I have, because the dialogue in the Tolstoy estate is notionally taking place in German, occasionally I just borrow a German expression or exclamation, just to give a little gentle reminder, sparingly, to the reader, oh yes, this is happening in German. And because my main character, Paul, is a German speaker, and the main Russian character, Katerina Trubetskaya, is a polished speaker of German, you know, there's a certain degree of they analyze themselves, the linguistic encounter that they're having.
The point of view is largely achieved through a very intimate third person, which is Paul's, your main kind of character's point of view. At times I wondered why you hadn't used first, because it is surprisingly intimate. And I just wonder what your thoughts and your planning were around the selection of the point of view.
So that intimate third person is something that I suppose is the thing that I feel most comfortable with. I like the flexibility it gives to you as a writer, the way in which really what happens is that the implied narrator is someone who's hovering just behind the viewpoint character. And there's a kind of a flickering that goes on between that, the strict viewpoint of, in this case, Paul, and then of this implied narrator. So, I mean, I once heard a description of what a sample sentence of what that intimate third person can give you. And I think the example was, Nigel sat in the concert hall listening to the music, stupid tears running down his face. And, you know, right there in that sentence, it seems to me that you've got that delicacy of what that point of view can provide. You know, that we know as the reader that they're not really stupid tears, and we know that the implied narrator doesn't think they're stupid tears. We know that Nigel in this situation is the one who's embarrassed and feeling that his tears are stupid. And there's an incredible, subtlety that is provided by that point of view. With first person, you're really much more strictly limited to what that particular person might say or think. It's absolutely something that I'm interested in doing and will definitely do in write in the first person. But it just so happens that I've gone for the third person again this time.
Yeah, I mean, in your example there of Nigel sat, you know, it's almost, those two words are almost implying that someone is on the side looking back at Nigel as well, because, you know, Nigel's not really aware that he's sitting. He's just being observed, really. So it does, I think you're your illustration does show us how, with a third person narrative, you can just slip towards omniscient and have these observations.
So it's gives you that arguably the best of both worlds. The first person, in a way, is a stricter discipline, and certainly, often in first person novels, there are to find things out about other characters. Yes, you have to set up interviews, if you like. But in any case, those are technical issues for maybe my next book.
And you manage quite long and involved discussions between Paul and Katerina about war and peace and other matters. Do you think that, you know, a reader needs to have some involvement with Tolstoy's work to appreciate your novel?
I would say definitely not. I think one of my aspirations was that a handful of readers might be tempted to look into Tolstoy or revisit Tolstoy if they hadn't already. But it's by no means necessary. The conversations are a risk. I think it's a general recommendation that characters don't discuss ideas in books, in novels. I think, the traditional, certainly mid-20th century view is that that's a sort of a deadening effect on a narrative, and that people need to be engaging in action. Or I resist that a little, because I think it's true to life that people, especially thoughtful, intellectual people, do spend their time sitting around discussing ideas and connecting over ideas. So I've taken a kind of calculated risk that the readers will go with me on that and also be interested. I mean, this in a way is a book for the true believers, you know, lovers of literature who like to reflect on books and the significance of literature in their lives. And, you know, I think it's by no means the only thing that's happening in this novel. There's plenty of action. I mean, one of my main passions as a writer is to really evoke the physicality of being alive. You know, in Paul's case, the sting of ice off the snow that's blown up by an Arctic wind, or the itching of lice in the seams of his uniform. You know, that's all there as well. I'm trying to jam in the whole of life, the physical, the emotional, the intellectual.
I mean, that's definitely true. With Paul, we experience so many things, even down to his long working in the operating room. The gruelingness of that is really very well evoked and very colourfully evoked. So, I'm just wondering too, with the kind of mass of intertextual references that you have to War and Peace, and indeed to other works of literature within the book, it kind of feels like, you know, the modern novel is entering the realm akin to sampling in music, where pieces can be taken and used and reused.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. Of course, the theorist would say that it was ever thus, and I mean that is also true, that Shakespeare, for example, you know, most of his work is sampling. He's sampling ancient sources and ancient texts and ancient stories and more contemporary stories as well, from Renaissance Italy, for example, that stories are woven from stories. There was, of course, a stage, you know, in the 80s, 90s, where that whole postmodernist writers were really glorying in that they were just absolutely reveling in intertextuality. I mean, I'm generalizing, of course. And it was a game and just a sheer playfulness. And I think that perhaps things have moved on a little, in the sense that there is a yearning I touched on before for authenticity, for something in this intertextual postmodern world that resembles truth, something we can cling on to. That's my intuition about what readers are yearning for, which is perhaps an explanation for the popularity of memoir, for example. So I haven't set out, to answer your question, to write a postmodern intertextual text, but Yes, it's happened, as you say, perhaps because of the time we're in, that is partly what I've produced.
The structure of the opening half of the novel is beguilingly simple, and I mean that in the nicest possible way, because I think a lot of times novels seem to be overly self-consciously complex, and whereas I found the opening half of your novel was just, as I said, beguilingly simple. There's some beautiful, elegant foreshadowing of future events. What was your strategy behind kind of constructing the first half of the novel in that manner?
Yes, of course, you're hinting there that particular approach doesn't continue. It's in that sense, it is more of an absolutely traditional pleasure that establishing a world, allowing the reader to inhabit it fully, and a more traditional novel, if you like. And I certainly was committed to absolutely allowing the reader that pleasure, that immersion in that world. And then, of course, I disrupt that. And I think it's, I'm happy to discuss how there is suddenly a letter between Paul and Katerina from the future. And in doing that, I was very conscious that it was a risk and that I was making sacrifices, that there's one of the obvious sacrifices is the reader immediately knows that Paul and Katerina survived the war. So there's a few things I was achieving or hoping to achieve. One is that I think that I knew that the readers were going to be, as perhaps you were, disconcerted to be suddenly wrenched out of the reality that I constructed. But I think readers do enjoy being surprised as well. I think that's, as long as doesn't seem like an utterly gratuitous or unrealistic surprise, I think being suddenly blindsided is one of the pleasures of reading. I mean, that's one of the pleasures of that classic twist in the tail of a story, that suddenly everything you thought was one way is suddenly turned on its head. So I think surprise is something I enjoy. When I'm writing, I like to, in a sense, outwit myself or surprise myself at some stage. But in another way, I was hoping to, well, I was achieving many things. I was shyly hoping that the suspense would just shift into another mode, that okay, you would know that, but you would want to know, okay, how did this new reality come to be? I have Katerina, for example, commenting at one stage, oh, those comrades of yours who were killed, what were their names again? Because suspense is not really primarily about just withholding information, because that would then be just merely obfuscation and mystery. Suspense is partly, it seems to me, if you look at the great masters of it, contemporary masters like Ian McEwan, it's about trailing bits of information like a matador trails a cape. And so those letters were partly planting little bits of information, thinking, oh, that's going to happen. And then finally, I made that decision, that sacrifice, that risk, took that risk, in order to inject the story with a gesture at the scale of War and Peace, that this is not just an intense claustrophobic setting that's taking place over 6 weeks. This is a story that spans decades and the whole lives of Paul and Katerina, as to give that, well, without sense of a saga without writing a saga, if you like.
You did run some fine lines, I thought, with gazumping your plot, but I thought that was kind of almost your point because, you know, to a large degree, reading this novel, we know the Germans lost, you know, from the beginning. Anyone who's read any history knows what happened. But it reminded me of The Unbearable Lightness of Being, where I think in the first few pages, the plot was just scuttled. You were just pretty much told what was going to happen. And it was like Kundera was saying, I'm not concerned with this. I'm concerned with other things, so I'll just get this out of the way.
Yeah, I think Like I said, if I know as a fact that some readers dislike the maneuver, and others, you know, I've had people, maybe they're just being complimentary to my face or on text saying, oh, that, at first I was disconcerted, and then I realized it was a masterstroke, which is perhaps overdone. I think the letters tend to mostly discuss Paul and Katerina's subsequent lives, and they're not too forthcoming about what actually happened in that 6-week period, that core of the story, which does continue, that is the essence of the novel. And so I'd like to think I haven't given away too much of what goes on to actually spoil those pleasures, but it's, I guess ultimately it's going to be a question of individual readers' preferences and tastes.
The homosocial really kind of underpins the exploration of a lot of the characters. I mean, it's a novel primarily about men in the military, but there are a lot of undercurrents of homosexuality. Paul is affected by Dieter Clemens' death, which occurs before the novel has actually commenced. Katerina provocatively asks Paul at one point if he is homosexual. And the lone identified homosexual character dies for unrequited love. I'm just wondering how comfortable you were with using that traditional literary trope of bury your gaze.
I think, yeah, that's a very challenging question. Thank you for asking a really challenging question. It's nice not to be just dished up Dorothy Dix's. I think that I'm going to be really overt here and try real openness. I think it's something that I'm still struggling with and perhaps haven't handled. Okay, I'm going to backstep here and approach from another direction. I feel it's unrealistic to ignore the experience of LGBTI characters in fiction, you know, and yet I think I'm still finding a way to grapple with it properly. I certainly do still have ideas, and I think that sense in which a character comes undone, as you say, for requited love, would be quite irritating for a lot of gay readers. In my defense, in my research, I'm coming across descriptions of summary court-martials in the field of German soldiers who have been discovered making love with it to each other and being, you know, hauled out and shot for it. But I can understand how gay readers, for example, might be irritated by that trope, as you say. I, as a young reader, I was, for the most part, effectively heterosexual, and I was obsessed as a young reader about young men in love with alluring, beautiful, mysterious women. And in many of those stories, those women had to die. The male author just couldn't bear it, in a sense, to allow her to live. And I got sick of that trope. So in a sense, I'm very sympathetic to anyone who might be fed up. I'm a big fan of Sarah Waters and her, you know, joyful romps, Victorian romps in particular, where lesbian characters are given permission to have happy endings. And, you know, one might quibble with how realistic they are. You know, are they a type of astonishing wish fulfillment? But there's no gainsaying they're exciting, they're emotionally rewarding and so on. And I'll have to be thinking about this in future, I think.
I didn't mean to suggest that I thought it was an unrealistic representation of what would have happened to someone in that situation, because, of course, you know, it was illegal and denigrated. But I'm just wondering if now that we have so many positive representations of homosexuality in literature and film, that we can now possibly return to investigate these old tropes. Like I'm thinking of, well, Annie Proulx in Brokeback Mountain was dragged over the coals for the death of Jack Twist at the end of that story. But I felt with that story that she was kind of saying, we've done enough now, we can go back and look at this again.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that in principle. I mean, I had an unpublished novel that had a couple of lesbian characters in it, and I felt that, you know, that women's writing and specifically lesbian writing, if we can characterize it that way, was big, bold, and bad enough to look after itself, and that this wasn't, in my case, a type of appropriation, but in a sense, a renaturalization of a male writer being fascinated and interesting enough about these people to give them the dignity and compliment of being represented. But this, this is touching on very, very contentious current cultural issues about appropriation, about who can tell whose story, and maybe at the moment it is it's up to gay writers perhaps to write bleak gay stories again. I mentioned Sarah Waters before, and I think it was her third novel, maybe her second, Affinity. That's also Victorian, and it has quite a dark, bleak take on the interactions of women in the 19th century, mutual betrayal and exploitation. So, but of course, as a gay writer herself, she's perhaps entitled to, or seen to be entitled to portray it that way.
Yeah, I'm thinking of other novels like E.M. Forster's Maurice, you know, which wasn't published until after his death, ends on a very happy note where these two characters ride off into an Italian sunset. But the novel's set before World War One, so it's always seemed to me there was this implication that, okay, it's ended on a happy note, but it ain't going to last long.
Absolutely, yes.
I'm just wondering, with the character Paul is evoked as the good German. He's not a member of the National Socialists. He's disillusioned by the war, but kind of very focused on his patients. So he's almost just trying to get through the war. With the present trend of recovering these untold stories, I wonder if that's kind of what Paul represents. And do we have to find the good egg in a bad dozen to reinvestigate these stories?
I think the answer to your last question, strictly speaking, is no. Now, a book that I haven't read, and I can't even recall off the top of my head the author's name, is a French novel, The Kindly Ones, which I guess I was a little daunted by the description. It's, you know, 1,000 pages of an SS officer, if I recall correctly, intriguingly enough, a gay SS officer, and the trail of destruction and cruelty and psychopathic acts that he perpetrates across Europe over 1,000 pages. And so there's a contemporary author who, in a way, is taking the trope of the evil German and ramping it up to the nth degree. So I'm saying it's, strictly speaking, not necessary. And of course, you know, some might complain about the trope of the good German. I personally am interested in what it is like to be someone doing their best in a difficult, brutal circumstances. I am almost certainly trying to write my own experience. I mean, when I characterize myself as a good person, of course it's more complicated than that, but you know, as a, once again, to risk of exaggerating, growing up in a boys' boarding school, a system that is in a sense a bit totalitarian, it's these stories about good people trying to get by in tough circumstances interests me. So that's why I've chosen Paul. I think I've also at the same time, though, in the case of the Tolstoy estate, tried very hard not to make it a whitewash. And so there are, of course, Nazi characters in his unit. And perhaps even more significantly, there are characters who I portray generally as likable, who are nevertheless at the same time casually anti-Semitic, for example. So it was very important for me to not whitewash the situation and say, oh, a bunch of good Germans turn up in Soviet Russia. One of the ways I characterize this novel with my tongue only half in my cheek is, you know, it's a dark Teutonic version of MASH. And I didn't want it to be just MASH, of course. The tone is quite different.
You have another kind of fairly severe rupturing of the text, apart from the letters, which do occur through the second half of the novel, when we all of a sudden fly forward to a chapter that's written in the present tense and told through Katerina's third person point of view. Katerina has written a novel called Europe 1975, and all of a sudden we're in 1975. It's almost like life is imitating or mocking art now that she's actually arrived at the point of her futuristic novel. I just kind of wonder again about your decisions about having that section towards the end, which, as you mentioned before, really does tilt the novel towards a saga.
Yes, I think I wanted primarily to give Katerina her own voice. I mean, she's a pretty, what's the right word? She's a pretty
feisty.
And articulate. She gets plenty to say, of course. But I just felt that it gave a type of, now, am I pronouncing the Italian correctly, diminuendo, ending at the end, that sort of soft, sad, reflective, but, you know, in a sense, uplifting, a kind of a, yeah, I was definitely after a particular type of ending that was reflective and thoughtful and expansive, primarily emotionally and metaphysically expansive. And once again, that basic, oh, let's give the reader a little start of surprise and see how they enjoy, he or she enjoys that.
Well, that's an interesting segue to my next question, because I think often I feel a lot of writers don't really actually consider the genders of their audience. And I'm just wondering, because your novel has tropes in it, it's about war, it's about men in war. So there are these tropes that make it appeal to a male reader, a traditional male reader. But you've also balanced that with Katerina and her concerns and things. So you've engendered the novel to a female readership as well. I'm just wondering if you do consider gender when you're writing.
I certainly do. I am very aware that as I understand it, about 80% of the readers of fiction are women. And I think to the extent that I'm conscious of these things, I mean, I love writing powerful characters per se, characters who will do and say anything. And that goes for male and female characters. You know, if you've got a character like, in my case, the anaesthetist, Herman Molyneux, who's this bon vivant buffoon in a way, but he's disinhibited and will say anything. That's a terrific character to have bursting off the page, a type of Dickensian character, if you like.
Yes, exactly.
And with Katerina, you know, she is also disinhibited by rage at this intrusion of the Germans. And so I enjoy her for her own sake, what she brings, the vibrancy she brings to the dialogue, to the scenes that she's in. But from, if you like, a somewhat more calculating perspective. I am conscious that it's more or less, I don't know if I'm overstating it, compulsory in contemporary literary fiction that there will be a strong woman. That I hope this, you know, maybe this sounds too calculating, but if gay readers are fed up with the trope of gay characters who come to a bad end, certainly women are fed up with the stories of mousy women who come to a bad end. So both by inclination and calculation, I have you know, would always look to having a strong woman character in a book that I wrote.
And just to finish up, we've discussed lightly today the concept of the authenticity of the writer who can write what, but I'm just wondering if you think a writer who is really doing their job and has done their research can be ageless and raceless and genderless.
The answer to that is that I believe that that is a type of aspiration that writers perhaps, or some writers, I mean, some writers just glory in their own subjectivity, but perhaps in, in other types of literature, the struggle to transcend your own subject position, to just see more broadly, more empathetically, I think that's a really worthwhile goal that's never going to be completely attainable. It's the holy grail that probably no author is ever going to quite reach, because, of course, we are products of our time. We are products of our gender. We can only do our best if we choose to go in that direction of that kind of capacious sympathy. And I mean, Tolstoy is one that comes very close, I would argue. One of my favourite novels is a novel that has come in for a bit of gender criticism, is Sophie's Choice. It's getting a bit back in time now, 1979, William Styron. I personally believe that's a very broad, generous novel about others' experience, the range of experience of men, women, people from different classes and races and religions. But it's not perfect. What work is, you know, there are moments in that book where Styron shows his irritation with the young women of his generation, the late 1940s, who wouldn't go to bed with him. You know, there's a kind of a grumpiness about it. And to me, shows he didn't quite appreciate what it was like to be a young woman in the 1940s with no reliable contraception. But, you know, that's a tiny little quibble in what I think is a terrific book, and that Styron, you know, miraculously in a way, manages to achieve that broader vision.
Well, thank you for your most enjoyable novel, and thank you for your time today. So, spasibo and do svidaniya. Or should we say grazie, ci vediamo un'altra volta?
Sì, ci vediamo un'altra volta. Sì.
Okay, grazie.
Thanks so much, Greg. I really appreciate your interest in the book. It's been a terrific conversation. As I say, great to have some really challenging questions, not just the Dorothy Dixes.
This episode features just one of over 70 speakers in our HNSA conference program. Our guest of honour is Geraldine Brooks. Other speakers include Stephen Carroll, Rosalie Hamm, and Kate Nunn, to name just a few. There'll also be special guest appearances from international best-selling authors Kate Quinn, Ben Kane, and Elizabeth Chadwick. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past.